Well, I've got some Mumia straight off. Amy Goodman's got a commentary on something entirely not related to Gaza. I've got Joel Beinen talking about the latest machinations inside the Israeli cabinet. And then a big feature on Hiroshima and Nagasaki Day. There's a woman in Chicago who is at DePaul, who is a second generation, I can't say the word, her parents were in Hiroshima. And she has a whole curriculum of teaching about the bomb and how misrepresentations are happening. It's pretty fascinating. I'm getting this from a podcast called Nuclear Hot Seat. You can find that on your podcast availabilities. It's Libby Halevy. She's been doing it for years. And to her credit, she turned me on to this book called Nuclear is Not the Answer, and I've got an article in the latest Public Eye that draws on that piece, and it's focused both on the nuclear industry and the fact that the U of I has signed a deal with a corporation called Nano Nuclear, and they want to put a nuclear power plant right on Abbott power plant grounds, you know, right next to the rail tracks, where we've known that there have been derailments in the past, amongst other things. That's not my insight. That's Bruce Hannon's, who wrote an article in opposition to citing that plant. I think it should be in nobody's backyard or cornfield myself. But opinions you hear are those of the speakers and not necessarily shared by others. I'm doing a lucky lefty here. you got to call lefties, call in something too. We got Carol's Corner and yeah. Anyway, here's an underwriting announcement to kick it off to make sure that, I think I heard, Aaron do this one, so let's skip to Champaign Park District. We'll skip to the next one in line, actually.
Programming on WEFD is brought to you in part by ShambanaEats.com. Champaign Urbana's only publication highlighting the food and drink scene in Champaign and Urbana. Shambana Eats brings you behind the scenes of the local food industry. Who, how, where, and what you choose to eat next. ShambanaEats.com.
Programming on
Okay, that's a new one on me. And guy last night was using the USB. All right, let's get right to Mumia Abu-Jamal's commentary. It's not so much a commentary, it's another epitaph to a colleague, I guess one might say, in the movement. Longtime political prisoner, Mumia Abu-Jamal. Already gave a disclaimer. Interesting slogan I heard about Mumia's case is they want justice for Mumia and justice for Widow Faulkner, the cop that was killed, wasn't killed by Mumia, so that means his perp is still out there.
We remember Carolina Saldana, who helped spread news of our movement here in America to her brothers and sisters in Mexico. But she also brought news to us of struggles of the poor, the oppressed, the indigenous community, the working people of Mexico, and of her many stories that she shared with us. None is more chilling than her work on Ayotzinapa, where the state, using criminal elements, massacred over 40 students and young people who were trying to be teachers to educate indigenous and poor communities in Mexico. These people were disappeared because of their political beliefs. They were disappeared because they were young activists trying to make a better impact on their communities in Mexico. And Carolina brought those stories to us. She told us not only what happened, but why. And she explained and named many of the students who, to this day, many of their bodies have not been found. When we first heard about it, we were dumbfounded. We could not believe it, but we had to. The facts were the facts. And we live in an age of neoliberalism where governments can do anything and get away with it. She was brave. She was courageous. She spoke truth to power. And she told the stories of her community and other communities all around America. She told Mexicans about the Black liberation struggle, about Black August, the month of resistance remembered for well over a century in America and the Americas. She told our story of struggle against police violence and prison violence and repression in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania and throughout America. Carolina Saldana will never be forgotten. We remember her, we salute her, we think of her, and we remember her spirit. We thank her for the gift of her presence in this world, in Mexico, and in the hearts of many people in Black America. With love, not fear, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Hello, this is the Virginia Model.
All right, we're getting some play-ons here today. Well, the Ammons did a great show today with Grant and said a lot of stuff that was just really brilliant. They mentioned that they're going to be out at the Champaign-Urbana Days in Douglas Park in the North End, south part of the North End. The Blues Festival kicked off yesterday, and I missed the Painkillers, 4:30 to 7. A lot going on. Andrew Duncanson kicks it off, and Take a Ride Band with Michael Pelican at 3 o'clock. That's a great show, back from the West Coast. Therapy, great drummer, A+, Blue Tone Drivers, and Candy Froster in the Shades of Blue till 10 o'clock, and that's at the Bunny's parking lot. Free admission. Donations appreciated. Bring your own lawn and folding chairs. And they have raffles as a fundraiser, too. Lots of co-sponsors. But you can go to Prairie Crossroads Blues Society, PCBS, and find out the details. All right, plan your day. What am I doing next? Oh, Amy Goodman's breaking the sound barrier about an international conference that got a little coverage in corporate press, but since corporations are seeing lack of demand and oversupply of petrochemicals, they want to make more plastics, and it's another kind of fatal thing. And yeah, hope you're sitting comfortably. Again, a long piece from Libby Halevy on the anniversary of Hiroshima and Nagasaki with a scholar at DePaul University in Chicago. A bit of cultural stuff in it, too.
From thinking to action in the fight against plastics. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. In Geneva, Switzerland's Place des Nations, the plaza outside the United Nations campus, a replica of Auguste Rodin's famous sculpture, The Thinker, has been installed. Like the original, the seated figure holds his chin in hand, but the hand in this version also clutches several empty plastic bottles. A baby lays across his other arm, resting its head in the thinker's left hand. The thinker gazes down past the baby onto a sea of plastic waste that surrounds the statue. The statue's placement coincides with a 10-day summit inside the UN, where negotiators hope to finalize the Global Plastics Treaty, an ambitious effort to reverse the overwhelming amount of plastic waste polluting the environment and negatively impacting human health in countless ways. Canadian artist Benjamin Van Wong calls his piece The Thinker's Burden.
Over the course of the next 10 days, we're going to be slowly adding more and more plastic to this art installation to show the growing cost that is being passed on to future generations if we don't take urgent and immediate action now.
Van Wong told Agence France-Presse as he added plastic to the pile.
If you want to protect health, then we need to think about the toxic chemicals that are entering our environment. We need to think about limits on plastic production. We need to think about a strong, ambitious plastics treaty.
The Global Plastics Treaty was supposed to be finalized last year at a summit in Busan, South Korea. Negotiations broke down between two major blocs of nations, those seeking controls on plastics and harmful chemicals, and nations with economies largely reliant on fossil fuel production, like Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Russia. Since then, of course, U.S. President Donald Trump began his second term with his MAGA mantra of drill, baby, drill. His appointees, like Energy Secretary Chris Wright, a former fracking company CEO, are shutting down climate programs, attacking climate science, and promoting climate deniers to key policy positions. It's in this context that The Lancet, the premier British medical journal, has launched the Lancet Countdown on Health and Plastics, quote, a health-focused, indicator-based global monitoring system on plastics, unquote, with a global team of scientists led by Dr. Philip Landrigan, director of the Boston College's Global Observatory on Planetary Health.
The global plastics threat has been quietly worsening now for three or four decades. Global plastic production has increased 250 times since it began in the 1950s. It's on track to double by 2040 and triple by 2060.
Dr. Landrigan said on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
The reason plastic production is growing so rapidly and the reason it's the focus especially is on the production of single-use plastics is that the fossil fuel industry, which produces most plastic, 99% of plastic is made from oil, gas, and coal. The fossil fuel industry is pivoting to plastic manufacture as they see the market for fossil fuels declining. Maybe not as fast as we would like, but nonetheless, they see the long-term trend for the fossil fuel market going down. And so they're putting enormous resources into plastic.
Dr. Landrigan continued.
Plastic harms human health at every stage of the plastic life cycle, starting with the fracking, then through the manufacture and the fabrication of plastic products, and then finally on when plastic is discharged into the environment. That waste plastic contains thousands of toxic chemicals that cause human exposure and result in disease and disability and premature death.
The Lancet Group released a comprehensive report with their announcement detailing the scale of the problem. Plastic pollution has been found from the deepest ocean depths to the slopes of Mount Everest. Plastic nanoparticles infiltrate the human body from the brain to breast milk. The impacts on children are the most severe, Landrigan said.
Infants in the womb and young children are very vulnerable to plastics because they're going through these incredibly complicated, tightly choreographed processes of early development. And plastic contains thousands of chemicals ranging from phthalates to bisphenols to brominated flame retardants. Those chemicals get out of plastics. They get into pregnant women and then pass through to their children. They get into little kids. And in children, they can cause a whole range of diseases that encompass brain injury, resulting in decreased IQ, injury to the reproductive organs, resulting in decreased fertility when today's child becomes tomorrow's adult, and damage to the liver, which interferes with cholesterol metabolism and increases risk for obesity, for diabetes, for heart disease, and stroke.
Auguste Rodin's sculpture, The Thinker, was completed in 1879, 17 years after plastic was invented in England. Rodin intended the sculpture to be part of a larger epic piece called The Gates of Hell, inspired by Dante's Inferno. The Gates of Hell consumed much of Rodin's life and was only cast after his death. His pensive thinker, meanwhile, went on to achieve global renown on its own. We're now at a moment where life truly is imitating art. The fossil fuel industry is driving us into an inferno, accelerating the climate catastrophe and blocking meaningful action on climate and on the global plastics treaty. We're standing at a real-world version of Rodin's Gates of Hell, where thinking about the problem is no longer enough. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Wow, that was brilliant. I hadn't heard it, and I didn't hear his interview online, but this idea of they need a new outlet for their petrochemicals and they're good at pumping it. Joel Beinon, I don't know if it comes up in this interview, but he's a regular fellow. I have Beinart, Bennis, and Beinon that I go to quite frequently when they're available. A great insight. This is recorded, I think, what I'm getting at is there have been some changes subsequently. They don't really discuss the decision except as it's looming, I think. And that was attacking one of the last areas in the north, pushing people down to Rafah. Something about this humanitarian thing is that they're all doing it down on the southern part, on the ruins of Rafah, with the idea, I think, of pushing them into Egypt, pushing the Palestinians into Egypt, drawing them down. It doesn't come up a lot. Israel is de facto violating the Camp David Accord, and actually they were for quite a few months. In fact, it was even when at the death of Carter, who negotiated it, it didn't come up, the fact that they were really pretty much in defying the Camp David Accords about the border at Rafah and Egypt. Oh, well, it's the Beltway blinders, as I like to call them. Here's Brian Edwards Teeker getting over his second bout of COVID recently. Does Corona calls. You can look for that if you're still interested. And Joel Bynum, emeritus professor at Stanford, I guess it was.
The Education of Shireen Haddad. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!
Very special featured interview. In the deluge of atomic articles flooding the mainstream media in this short period of time.
Okay, well, in my haste this morning, I copied the wrong file, so I don't know how I'm going to do that. So let's go to Hiroshima, Nagasaki first, and I'll see what I can fill out the show with. I think I'll try and get the Bynum thing. I manipulated it and sped it up a little bit, but I'll get up front for the end of the show, I guess.
Special featured interview. In the deluge of atomic articles flooding the mainstream media in this short period of time, this is in response to an anniversary that ends in a zero, you will find that most deal with the political and social issues faced by the world 80 years ago, the science of the bomb, the personalities of the men who created it, and evaluations of our current growing nuclear dilemma. Because all survivors of those bombings are at least 80 years old, and most will likely not be around 10 years from now, they will be allowed their say in media to recount their stories and then urge the world to get rid of all nuclear weapons. They've done it before. This year will be no different. At Nuclear Hot Seat, we welcome this explosion of nuclear awareness in the media. But what is missing from the majority of these reports is the human element. What happened to the people after the bombings? And not just the Hibakusha, the survivors of the attacks, but the people who followed them, their children, grandchildren, and society itself. What was the bomb's lasting impact on Japan, and especially the women? To find out, I spoke with someone representing not only her own familial history, but her professional research into how the image of the bomb has been portrayed, especially in America, and how a younger generation is being prepared to carry on the story and the warnings from August 6 and 9, 1945. Yuki Miyamoto is a professor in the Department of Religious Studies and director of the Humanities Center at DePaul University in Chicago. Since earning her PhD from the University of Chicago, she has been teaching nuclear ethics and environmental justice at DePaul. In addition to leading a biannual study abroad program, bringing DePaul students to Hiroshima and Nagasaki for 2 weeks, her team project, Teach Nuclear History, and that's TEAACH Nuclear History, is an initiative focused on teaching nuclear issues to inner-city middle school students. Yuki is Nisi Hibakusha, a second-generation Hibakusha. You'll understand more about that during the interview. And she brings a personal perspective to her powerful work. We spoke on July 11, 2025. Yuki Miyamoto, thank you so much for joining us for this special edition of Nuclear Hot Seat.
It's always my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
First of all, tell us your personal background as regards the U.S. bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
I was born in Japan in 1968. So when I was growing up, still the elementary school teachers, some of them were actual people who experienced the bombing, whom we call Hibakusha. So teachers were Hibakusha, and kids in the neighborhood, their families, one or two or more, the members of their families were affected by the bombs. And my mother's family, they were living a mile away from the hypocenter. And my mom, officially, she was with her family at home, which is a mile away from the hypocenter. But most likely, she was at the elementary school, which is even closer to the hypocenter. And approximately 100 kids were killed instantly. And somehow my mother survived, but she never told me about her experiences, even though she was 6 years old, which I suppose that it's old enough to remember such a traumatic, you know, huge historical event. But she never told me. So I learned about her experience from her older sister, who is my aunt. And she was not quite healthy in me growing up. In her 30s, she had menial disease. In her 40s, she was not able to produce healthy blood cells. So she had to take blood booster kind of shots every other week. In her 50s, she got cancer and she passed away a long time ago at the age of 62. So that's my kind of personal relations to this historical event.
What has your work been and how has it been influenced by these bombings?
Growing up in Hiroshima, and especially in the 70s, 80s, there were still lots of nuclear tests going on. And every time nuclear countries conducted nuclear tests, the mayor of Hiroshima sent a telegram, or activists would come to the Peace Memorial Park and made some demonstrations and stuff. So growing up, seeing efforts that people are making not to conduct nuclear tests anymore, and having seen that, but reality, it doesn't seem that nuclear tests were going to stop at any time soon, at least I felt in the 80s, let alone the abolition of nuclear weapons. So I wanted to know, this must be something, for example, the U.S. must have some kind of explanation or rationale so that people don't feel like the abolition of nuclear weapons is an urgent matter. So I wanted to learn about narratives. But back then, I didn't know such a fancy word, but I thought that maybe national narrative would be different from that of the one which I grew up with. So I wanted to come here to study narrative and analyze narratives. In a larger context, I wanted to know what the good things to do, or what society conceptualized good. So like during the war in Japan, of course, a good thing is to die for the emperor. But after the war, that was not a good thing anymore. It's not a national agenda anymore. So that sort of past history of Japan and made me think of narratives, national, especially national narratives, collective narratives. And so that's why I came here. So I studied how the U.S. constructed narratives, which I didn't publish in English, but I published it in Japanese. And my English publication is about how this historical event has been narrativized or represented.
This most recent paper that you published, Unbearable Lightness of Bombing, Normalizing Violence and the Horror of the Atomic Bomb Experiences, explores the ways in which the atomic bomb has been understood through representations in media to general audiences. What have you found about how that has affected public perceptions of the bombings this long after the fact?
This paper is centering around a group of women who are referred to as Hiroshima Maidens, who were invited to the United States. And they were 23 young women. However, they were 10 years prior to their coming to the United States. They had experienced the bombing. And because of that, they were scarred and disfigured. And interestingly, this was not much known, but those women were actually suffering from, not just from the physical effects of the atomic bombings, but also social stigma. They faced discrimination by the fellow Japanese citizens.
What kind of discrimination did they face and what was the basis for it?
And especially this is for women because society tends to put burden or to put responsibility of bringing a healthy child to the world onto women's shoulders. Society paid attention to women's health much more so than now. It's still in Japan, and especially in the 50s, handing down the family's name, so having kids, was very important in Japanese society. So those women who were not considered as healthy or healthy enough to have healthy kids to the world or to the family, but also they were metaphysically considered their blood was tainted or their genes were mutated. So that is scientifically inconclusive. I'm not saying either. I'm not saying that there was no such influence to the second and third and, you know, the future generations. I'm not saying that. But I'm also not saying that there is such thing. It's just inconclusive when it comes to the generational influences from the bombing and radiation exposure. But because of this metaphysical conceptualization of hibakusha, people tend to shun women who were affected by the bomb. So not only their physical disfigurement, but also this sort of ontological differences that they are carrying bad genes or tainted blood.
This may be too personal, and if it is, I apologize and we can skip over it. But you were obviously born to a mother who was hibakusha, who was very close to the explosion when it happened, and you were born in the 1960s. Has there been any impact on your health that can be traced back to this?
Not that I can think of, and I'm not sure if this is something I'm unconsciously suppressing, because on the one hand, I feel like, well, of course there is influence, right? But on the other hand, no, I don't want to believe in it. You know, I don't want to think about it. So I'm always kind of having this tag of war torn between these two concepts. And I would like to sort of maintain the tension. I just don't want to go into one side and completely dismiss the other. I would like to have these two emotions together at the same time. However, having said that, my cousin, who was born around 15 years prior to me, so was born in the 50s in Hiroshima, and her mother was also hibakusha, she developed autoimmune disease in her 30s and almost bedridden for 2 decades and passed away in her 50s. And I just couldn't think of, you know, this must be because of her mother's experience of the atomic bombing. But I'm also very hesitant to say that because that would put burdens on all hibakusha, including beyond Hiroshima and Nagasaki, right? Anyone who were exposed to radiation.
Let's move back to the Hiroshima maidens, the ones who were sent to the United States. What was done for them and what was done to them in the United States?
Right. Because, you know, as I said, they were shunned and they themselves internalized it. They were ashamed of their appearance. They were looking for or seeking for some kind of emotional shelter. And they found one, which is a Christian church, Methodist minister, Tanimoto Kiyoshi, who kind of took them under his wings and he was giving some comfort. And he and Norman Cousins, the essayist, the editor of the Saturday Review, they fundraised and brought those women to the United States so that they could get plastic or reconstruction surgery free of charge. So that was their project. I believe that it's also the U.S. Army contributed too, because they went to the United States by army plane from this U.S. base, Iwakuni, which is the closest one to Hiroshima, on their way. On their way back to Japan, they used a commercial airplane, but on their way to come to the United States, the military plane brought them to the United States. And then they went to Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. And once they get here, the Quakers were the ones who took care of them, whose household they stayed, those women stayed. And so it was over 1 year. Some of them took multiple surgeries while they were in the United States. And one of them, unfortunately, died during the surgery because of heart failure. But others went through more than a couple of surgeries. So that's the story.
Were they in any way portrayed in U.S. media at that time? Or were they perhaps exploited by the media in some form because they were there and in the United States, and weren't we doing a good thing for them?
Right. Thank you for saying this, because actually we could see the TV show, This Is Your Life. And that TV show actually invited, more like focusing on Reverend Kiyoshi Tanimoto, or Tanimoto Kiyoshi in Japanese name order, and his activities, his friends in the United States. He had studied in the United States prior to the war, so he had some minister friends. So the program is kind of focusing on him and his family, but also there were two women, Hiroshima maidens, two women, quote-unquote, appeared in this show. And why I'm saying quote-unquote, because they were behind the screen. And the MC is saying, for the sake of preventing them from being embarrassed, or some kind of word using embarrassment, like, we are saving them from embarrassment, we don't show their faces. So you can kind of tell that how they were presented in this show and whose embarrassment was this, right? Is that really those women should be embarrassed? But anyway, so that was the show, This Is Your Life, which you can probably still watch on YouTube. Unless it was taken down for some reason, you can definitely watch it. This Is Your Life and Tanimoto, those are the keywords.
Send me the spelling of the name and I will do a search. And if and as I find it, I will, of course, link to it on this episode.
But one more thing, can I add?
Absolutely.
There is a pilot showed up. And there was a very awkward moment that Reverend Tanimoto and this pilot who was engaged with this project of, you know, this dropping the bomb. The pilot seemed to me to be very regretful. He was kind of looking down. He put his hand onto his forehead and he was saying, when I saw the explosion, we were saying, oh, what have we done? And then he donated some money to the Tanimoto's fundraising efforts for the Hiroshima Maidens. It was a very awkward because this pilot who dropped the bomb and Kiyoshi Tanimoto, who was on the ground, they had to shake hands.
Wow.
And, yeah. You know, they saw eye to eye. And then, so they had to shake hands.
That would have been Tibbetts. And I do not recall coming across anything attributed to him that showed regret.
Right, right. Not Tibbetts.
Was it Sweeney?
No, not Sweeney. You know, Sweeney is in Nagasaki, right? And not Tibbetts. So I shouldn't say pilots. So one of the crew members of this dropping the bomb, who appeared on the show meeting Tanimoto, he seemed to be very regretful, putting his hand over his forehead, looking down and saying, when we saw after dropping the bomb, we say to ourselves, what have we done? And donated some money to the Hiroshima Maidens. And Tanimoto and this crew member, they had to shake hands. Not had to, but you know, that was courtesy. So it was very awkward, but they shook hands.
It's an astonishingly wrong-headed moment. And I'm just stunned by that one. Talk about a manufactured moment of too little, too late. Let's move this along. You have done quite a bit of study as to how the bombing is represented in the media. And I think it's clear from what we're hearing from our younger generations that many of them don't even know anything about the bomb, let alone the truth of it. So the general public, certainly here in the United States, does not understand about atomic bombings. You have done quite a bit of study as to how the bombing is represented in the media. And I think it's clear from what we're hearing from our younger generations that many of them don't even know anything about the bomb, let alone the truth of it. So the general public, certainly here in the United States, does not understand about atomic bombings. How have entertainment media, such as movies and TV programs, or even news stories, contributed to this blackout of the consequences and the seriousness of what happened when the atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
I think one thing, because I grew up in Hiroshima and in my classroom library, there were a couple of volumes of Barefoot Gen. And I don't know if you are familiar with this graphic novel, but very, very graphic, like melting skins and people's bodies were decomposed and those maggots swarming around, you know, very, very graphic. So day one in this education system, we encountered what it was like, and especially human tolls. Like, what do those bombs do to human bodies? So that was very much inscripted in my mind from age six, right, growing up. One thing which I was a little bit, well, I guess not quite surprised, but what I discovered is that there were very few portrayals or imagery of people who were affected by the bombing or radiation exposure in the United States. And so, you know, we've seen some scorched land or demolished buildings and crumbled buildings and all those images, but hardly see human bodies there. I think that's part of it. But of course, media developed afterwards. We are not only talking about immediate after the bombing. And after the bombing in the 50s, this Hiroshima Maidens were portrayed as kind of reconciliation, which was not just in the United States, in Japan as well. There was some reconciliation project going on. Those Hiroshima Maidens, a different kind of group, but the same kind of disfigured women were invited to Tokyo for reconstruction surgery, and they had to meet the Class A war criminals and sort of reconciling them. So they were being used for reconciliation in both in Japan and in the United States. And afterwards, in the 80s, in Japan, there were a couple of TV shows and movies about women, young women, who were affected by the bombing, either directly or rather indirectly. I'm talking about Black Rain, whose protagonist was affected by nuclear fallout, but not necessarily the explosion by itself. And the other protagonist of this very popular TV shows in Japan, she was exposed to radiation while she was in her mother's womb, so in utero. And both were young maidens, quote-unquote maidens, and died a premature death. So always, like, those young women died prematurely, and it's sad, but there is some kind of relief included in it because they died without leaving their offspring behind. So that kind of representational, almost iconic representations, usually women, maidens.
I'd like to roll this back a little bit because you raised the point of showing after the bombing that there was rubble and the buildings were destroyed and wasn't that terrible, but that there were no depictions of the damage to people. And I refer to those pictures, which were taken a minimum of 1 month after the actual bombing. I refer to that as scrubbed rubble. Because I did a tremendous amount of research into this as part of a play that I've written called Atomic Bill and the Payment Due. And the manipulation was that they never showed the dead bodies. There was one Japanese newsreel crew that was able to get into Hiroshima the day after the bombing, and they took the real footage. I've seen pieces of this, and it shows not even bodies, bones, skulls littering all over the place. And it's heartrending, and it's horrific, and it really brings forth the impact. But what most people are not aware of is that Douglas MacArthur was appointed the Supreme Commander for the Allied Powers over Japan by President Truman. And his immediate first move was to remove the bodies, all trace of them, the bones, whatever, from Hiroshima. I do not yet know where they were disposed of, but they were bulldozed out of there. The second thing is that he made Hiroshima completely off limits unless there was prior approval. And there was someone from the U.S. military to steer any reporters who were allowed there. They were never allowed in the hospitals to see the people who were suffering from radiation poisoning or who were suffering still from the effect of the blast. It was manicured. The coverage was manicured. The big thing he did, though, that is really horrific, not only were there no studies of the impact of what happened to people as a result of the bombing physically, MacArthur made it illegal for there to be any reporting on the survivors of the bomb and their ongoing problems with their health. And he specifically prevented there being any media, anything, talking with doctors, reporters, or the survivors themselves about what had happened. It was a total blackout, which is why you don't see what we would expect as quote-unquote human interest stories, the kind of coverage that happens after a disaster where people are focused on and their particular stories are checked on, and on the anniversary there's more coverage like that. None of that was allowed. It was illegal, and there was prison time if anybody attempted it. So because of that, there was a complete blackout, certainly to America, of the impact of the atomic bomb on the people of Hiroshima and by extension Nagasaki. How do you think that total blackout has impacted our current understanding of the nuclear bomb and what the United States did to those two cities and the people in them?
Definitely, not just MacArthur, but many of those people who were involved in the Manhattan Project, they told people not to talk about radiation exposure and its aftermath. There is no such thing, radiation exposure and the health hazard from it. And also there's a book, Atomic Doctors, I think, James Nolan. His grandfather went to Hiroshima in already September, October, around there, and they found something about radiation exposure effect, but they were dismissed. And they themselves felt some kind of, you know, they had diarrhea in Hiroshima, but they think like it's because of different diet. And so they tried to rationalize themselves. And also Japanese doctors as well. There is a doctor who passed away about 10 years ago. He was in Hiroshima. He himself was Hibakusha, Shuntaro Hida. And he told me a couple of times that because he was not allowed to leave the records of the patients that he was seeing, but without those records, he was not able to offer a good treatment. So he was secretly keeping the records. But then he was found, he was thrown into jail. And he's such a, you know, gentle, like very nice guy, always smiling and telling me with a big smile. So I was thrown into jail three times of that. So that's the time back then. So it was surprising that John Hersey actually made it. only a year after the bombing. And he was also using a lot of networks to get there because, as you said, MacArthur wasn't allowing those journalists to come into Hiroshima or Nagasaki.
It seems that in the years since the bombings, the most specific work and the most graphic work have been coming from artists representing the horror of those bombings. You mentioned the graphic novel. And also, at the beginning of the paper that I cited, you were inspired by a skywriting event that took place on October 21st of 2008, when the word Pika, P-I-K-A, the Japanese version of the sound of that English name, was drawn by a small airplane's exhaust in the sky over Hiroshima. And this was done by a group called Chimpom. What is Chimpom, and what was the significance and impact of that event?
Chimpom is a group of young artists, and they are trying to engage in social issues. And the reason why they did, and also Pika is an onomatopoeia in Japanese, indicating the flash. And because the atomic bombing was known as Pika Don in Hiroshima for a long time, and that was onomatopoeia. Pika is flash, Don is roar coming from the explosion. So Pika or Pika Don, referring to the atomic bombing, and they used the word Pika and drew the word in the sky. Their intention is that they wanted to raise awareness that we are so used to being living in a peaceful time, so wanted to raise awareness of the atomic bombing, of the war. So the intention itself was not wrong, but my take is that the people in Hiroshima needed to be reminded by them, and especially many of them were Hibakusha or Hibakusha's children. Why did they do that? I know it's symbolic because it's not just in any sky. It's over the Hiroshima Atomic Bomb Dome, which is an iconic figure in Japan. It was designated as UNESCO's Historical Heritage Landmark. So it's definitely symbolic. But at the same time, people are still living there. And I just wonder why they chose to take the position of American pilots showing that to us. That is unsettling part of this art representation.
Are there any other artists, groups, or artworks that you are aware of that are being created in light of this being the 80th anniversary of the dropping of the bombs?
Yes. At the same time as Chimpom's performance, there was another artist, which is well-known, Chinese-born artist called Tsai Guo-chan, I want to say, but I'm not sure of my pronunciation. My pronunciation is off. And he's a well-known artist. And he was actually commissioned by the city of Hiroshima to make an art. And what he did, he is also known for his pyrotechnic work, artwork. And he was probably known because he was also commissioned by the University of Chicago to commemorate the 75th anniversary of the first self-sustained chain reaction took place at the very university. And his work was this explosion of fireworks and at that time, like almost rainbow-colored, beautiful fireworks.
I was in Chicago for that event commemorating the first sustained chain reaction. And while I did not see the fireworks live, I did find a picture of it and use it on the nuclear hot seat site. And I thought it was an atrocious contradiction and a celebration of something that rained down death and destruction in so many places. So I found his work, while I could admire his skill, I didn't admire the artistic vision behind it because I thought it was propaganda.
Indeed. I'm going to excerpt that there. I mentioned that that's from a podcast called Nuclear Hot Seat with Libby Halevy out on the West Coast, I think, though she's interviewing Yuki Miyamoto, who is a professor at DePaul in Chicago and has a curriculum teaching nuclear ethics and environmental justice, Teach Nuclear History. TAACH Nuclear History is the initiative that she has for focusing on teaching nuclear issues to inner city middle school students. So, yeah, didn't know that was going on. She has a short piece called Unbearable Lightness of Bombing, Normalizing Violence and Banalizing the Horror of the Atomic Bomb Experience. And that, again, is Nuclear Hot Seat, which has a website under the same name as well. If you heard from the beginning, you can hear the entirety there and some other material, too, from ICANN, a group that wants to abolish nuclear weapons. But I did mention Joel Beinan, and I did have it with me. I just didn't have it in
the player that I need to start it in right now, and we'll close out. This is Brian Edwards Tiekert's morning show on the Left Coast on KPFA, and Joel Beinen is an emeritus professor of Middle East studies on at Stanford, especially as labor issues throughout the Maghreb and other places in the Middle East, but Egypt particularly. But he's also doesn't come up in this, I don't think. He had a niece who was at the rave that was attacked on October 7th.
Directions. On Thursday, a letter went public addressed to U.S. President Donald Trump and signed by 600 former Israeli security officials, some of them very high ranking, former heads of the agencies that are equivalent of the FBI and CIA, as well as high ranking military officials, calling on Donald Trump to pressure Israel to end the war in Gaza, basically saying any aims that could plausibly be achieved by military force had already been achieved. The next day, Benjamin Netanyahu gets his government to vote to fire the attorney general who is prosecuting Benjamin Netanyahu on bribery and corruption charges. That is immediately stayed by the Supreme Court. The next day, news breaks that Netanyahu is apparently in private security cabinet meetings advocating for an expansion of Israel's war in Gaza to a full military occupation of the entirety of the Gaza Strip, which would be a massive escalation, both in terms of the impact on Gazans and in the amount of resources and people it would draw from Israeli society to maintain that occupation. In the past, these are the kinds of things that have stirred up domestic protests in Israel. Joining us to talk about the situation, Joel Beinen, Professor of Middle East History Emeritus at Stanford University. Good morning.
Good morning, Brian. You did an excellent job running down the recent events in Israel.
It is my job to wake up early, drink coffee, and read the news. So let's start with the letter. The names attached to this letter, the fact that it was addressed to Donald Trump rather than anyone in Israeli politics, what's the significance of this? What's the valence of this to a member of the Israeli public reading this?
The main figures in Benjamin Netanyahu's government are lightweight nobodies. There's no point in addressing anything to them because they are all under Netanyahu's thumb and have no independent discernment. Many people, a large majority of Israeli Jews, believe that Donald Trump is what can save them, even if they don't like him particularly because of his domestic positions in the United States. But the fact that he weighed in and got Israel to agree to a ceasefire with Hamas at the last minute back in January, the fact that Aidan Alexander, an American citizen, was released and was held hostage by Hamas, was released by Hamas apparently as a personal favor to Donald Trump, those measures made it seem like only Donald Trump can put the requisite pressure on Netanyahu to do anything. But since Israel unilaterally violated the truce that Donald Trump supposedly got Israel to agree to in January, Israel violated the truce in March and began fighting again and concurrently starving the people of Gaza, I don't think there's actually much basis to think that Trump would intervene in a useful way. But when people have no other option, they grasp at straws.
I mean, this is also kind of the theory of power of most people doing pro-Palestinian activism here in the United States, is that the United States, as Israel's primary champion on the United Nations Security Council, as its principal supplier of weapons, has the actual leverage to bring about an end to the war.
The United States has the leverage if it would use it. The likelihood of the United States using the leverage is very, very small.
The significance of these figures from past Israeli governments, from the security agencies and the military, basically saying there's nothing left to accomplish in Gaza.
Yes, it's been the case for some time that the leading professional figures in the military and security establishment have a consensus that Israel has done what it can do in Gaza. And that any further military action would first and foremost endanger the hostages, because that's top of the list of concerns for the Israeli public, although not for the Israeli government. And secondly, it would entail huge expenses and would require mobilization of tens of thousands of reservists who are already totally exhausted. A record number of reservists are coming home and committing suicide after serving in Gaza or the West Bank. The morale of the army is not high. So they want to end this and reorganize and restore the army to a reasonable condition. And similarly, the head of the former head of the Shin Bet, Ronen Bar, was himself fired. And then the Supreme Court intervened and said, no, the government can't fire him. But then ultimately in June, he resigned anyway, short of serving his full 5-year term, which was to have ended in 2026. And he, too, had all manner of critiques of the government, both for the way it was conducting the war in Gaza, but also over the fact that Netanyahu has insisted that there cannot be an official state-level investigation into the security failures of October 7th. Why? Because any such investigation would certainly point fingers at him for his own lapses on that day and preceding October 7th.
So the concern for hostages still being held in Gaza, as I understand it, is twofold. One is obviously if you're bombing and shelling a place, you might bomb and shell the hostages being held there. But the other is that if the people holding them captive sense that their position's about to be overtaken by Israeli forces, they will, and they have, executed hostages before letting them be recovered.
Exactly. And the particular point which is at issue here is that according to the intelligence that the Israelis say they have, there are neighborhoods in Gaza City, which Israel has not yet fully conquered, where they believe the hostages are being held. And if there will be an all-out assault on Gaza Strip, including Gaza City, which is what Netanyahu is calling for, then those hostages will be endangered for the reasons that you said.
So the impression one gets from social media posts is that the entirety of Gaza is already rubble with starving people crawling amongst the ruins. How much is actually left to like conquer in these neighborhoods in Gaza City?
So different cities are in different stages of devastation. I also saw a social media post yesterday which said 89% of the buildings in Rafah have been destroyed or are severely damaged. Similar level of destruction in Khan Yunis. In Jabalia, almost total destruction. But there are still these neighborhoods in Gaza City where a significant number of buildings are still standing, and where, most important, there are tunnels that have not yet been discovered and destroyed by the Israeli forces. And that's where, according to the intelligence, some number of the hostages are being held. There are, again, according to Israeli intelligence, 50 hostages, of which 20 are believed to be alive.
So the news breaks through anonymous sourcing in the Israeli press that Benjamin Netanyahu is telling his security cabinet he wants to go to a complete conquest of Gaza and military occupation of Gaza. The first thing that seems to be implicit in this news is he doesn't care about those hostages' lives.
I think that is correct. From early on, some of the families of people who were held hostage in the Gaza Strip, including my own family, argued that it's simply not a priority for Netanyahu to save the lives of the hostages. If it had been a priority, Israel would not have begun with the massive bombing campaign that it began in the latter part of October. It is believed that that bombing campaign alone led to the death of several of the hostages. If you were concerned with the hostages, first and foremost, some indirect outreach to Hamas would have been made very early on, because Hamas said in the beginning, okay, we have hostages, let's negotiate. And Israel ignored that.
More importantly, Israel entered into a ceasefire agreement with Hamas at the start of this year that included steps toward a complete release of hostages, until Israel stepped right back out of that ceasefire agreement.
Exactly. Because Netanyahu has always said that whatever ceasefire agreements are reached with Hamas can only be temporary, because he wants to continue the war until total victory, which was the Israeli slogan, although the great majority of Israeli people don't believe in that anymore. But Netanyahu is still holding that out as the objective, total victory over Hamas, meaning a complete military defeat of Hamas, the surrender of its leadership, disarmament of Hamas, expulsion of the Hamas leadership from the Gaza Strip, and no role for Hamas in the future governance of the Gaza Strip. That's the strategy of Netanyahu and his supporters.
So I know, like, we're relying on anonymously sourced secondhand accounts of what Netanyahu is saying in closed-door meetings right now, but do we understand a full military occupation of the Gaza Strip to also mean that Israel is going to take responsibility for being the governing authority in Gaza?
Well, that would seem to be the logical outcome, but everyone has asked since very early on, what is the Israeli government's plan for the day after? And they have never produced one. So we don't know exactly what would happen if Israel could successfully conquer the entire Gaza Strip, which its own military and intelligence elites are saying is not possible and should not be done.
In terms of the impact on Israeli society, how big a draw up of military reserves does this require? How much, you know, internal dissent is there over this kind of mobilization?
So the number that has been bandied about is that 100,000 reserves would be required to carry out what Netanyahu is proposing to do. That's a substantial increase over the number now, but I don't have that number at hand. There is enormous dissent within Israel. It is narrowly focused, first and foremost, on the person of Netanyahu, who we should not forget is still on trial for three charges of corruption, breach of public trust, and using his influence for favorable media treatment. So that's one axis of dissent and protest, and there has been an uptick in it in public protest in recent weeks. Second is the hostages. Israeli society was shocked last week by the release of videos of two of the hostages who were emaciated. And there was lots of talk about how Israel, Hamas is starving the hostage. Well, Israel is starving the entire Gaza Strip. How would anyone expect that the hostages are going to be eating better than the rest of the people in Gaza if there's not enough food for everybody? So the Israeli media spins this in a very weird way, but those pictures shocked a lot of people into being concerned once again about the fate of the hostages. So there's demonstrations, especially being led by the families of the hostages, demanding that Netanyahu agree to a ceasefire that would return the hostages, and even calling for an end to the war and a exchange of captives that would accompany that. Go ahead.
To put these figures in context for our American audience, an Israeli commitment of 100,000 troops relative to their population, that would be the equivalent of 3 million from this country, which would entail, for that level of military effort, the United States, the largest military power in the world, deploying every single active duty military service member it has, every reservist and member of the National Guard, and then drafting and deploying an additional million people beyond that. Sustaining that level of mobilization for any period of time has got to have like a profound impact on society and the economy in Israel.
It already has, because even short of that very, very high level of mobilization of the reserves, tens of thousands of reservists have been mobilized over the course of the last 22 months. Some have served as many as three tours of duty in Gaza and or the West Bank, which is another boiling point that people haven't been paying perhaps enough attention to. And the cost economically to Israeli society has been very great. The cost in the morale of Israeli society has been very great. Tens of thousands of Israelis have left the country. A mutual friend told me that there are now 40,000 Israelis in Toronto, Canada alone. I don't know what the figures are for people who are in Berlin or New York, which are other favorite sites of immigration, but several tens of thousands all told in each of those places, maybe even 100,000. So there's been immigration, and it's a brain drain. It's the people with the most portable skills, typically high tech or medical or things like that. So Israeli society has taken a very big hit as a result of this war already. Saying that, this is minuscule compared to the impact of the war on Palestinian society in the Gaza Strip, which had been absolutely devastating. We have to keep that in our minds. And that is the point which the great majority of Israelis, even those who are protesting, are for the most part not keeping to the forefront. There's been...
Programming on WEFT is brought to you in part by the Canopy Club, hosting live music and events, including the Piano Man, every Monday night. The Canopy Club has